Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinions, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Daniel Reimold will talk about the rise of the campus sex columnist. Also, I review Dr. Laura's career not just for the racism that ended her radio show, but for the misogyny that she got away with for years. And a look at the reactions to a Colorado high school's common sense provision of birth control to its students. The racist and sexist meme of anchor babies hasn't gone away, and it's only getting stronger. Now you have politicians exploiting the belief that immigrants don't have a right to give birth in Rhode Island.
We have, you know, we've all heard of Anka babies. We have something unique to Rhode Island, and they're called Anka embryos. And what it is, a policy that we have in the state of Rhode Island, if you're an illegal alien woman and you're pregnant, and you come to Rhode Island, and you get to the Department of Human Services, the first thing you have to do is tell them that you're an illegal alien woman and you're pregnant. And the Department of Human Services will offer you, do you want Blue Cross, United, or Neighborhood Health?
Unsurprisingly, this politician, Peter Palumbo, a Democratic state representative from Rhode Island, is also anti-choice. He's against abortion rights, but he's also against women carrying pregnancies to term if he deems them the wrong race or nationality. He doesn't want women to terminate pregnancies, but he doesn't want them to have good health care while pregnant. These seem like contradictions, unless you assume a measure of just blatant misogyny. You may have heard the news about Dr. Laura, but if not, a quick recap. A black woman called into Dr. Laura's show to ask for advice on how to deal with her white husband's racist family. Dr. Laura accused her of being oversensitive, and then went on a rant where she used the N-word roughly 11 times, and then took a pot shot at black people who voted for Obama. This racist rant caused a firestorm of criticism, and this is how it ended.
I'm here to say that my contract is up for my radio show at the end of the year, and I've made the decision not to do radio anymore. The reason is I want to regain my First Amendment rights. I want to be able to say what's on my mind and in my heart and what I think is helpful and useful without somebody getting angry, some special interest group deciding this is a time to silence a voice of dissent and attack affiliates and attack sponsors.
Not that I think Dr. Laura will be going away forever, sadly. She indicated that she has other kinds of media that she wants to pursue. But I do think this is a good time to talk about how Dr. Laura has always been a prime piece of evidence against the conservative contention that they're not misogynist and that their desires to control female sexuality have nothing to do with sadism or misogyny. I call it the nuh-uh defense, and Dr. Laura is a prime example of how the right-wing media just pushes mean-spirited, spiteful, prejudiced views of women in general, and how the anti-choice sentiment grows from that. Amanda Hess did us all a favor by chronicling Dr. Laura's long-standing viciousness against women that she peddled, usually by putting herself out as the exception to the rule. For instance, Dr. Laura had no problem encouraging women to view other women as subversive sluts out to get your man, as she did when a woman wrote in freaked out because her boyfriend has a good female friend who is a platonic friend.
You know what? It depends. So while you're dating him, you have to see, does he go to her to complain about his relationship with you? Does he spend a lot of time every day texting and calling and emailing and spending time? You really have to assess the quality of what this so-called best friendship is. Is this someone he tells the privacies of his life to? I mean, ultimately, that would be his wife, and if it would work out, that would be you. So instead of me just making a blanket statement, because of course heterosexual men and women can be friends, but more often than not, one of the two has deeper feelings about the other, which keeps them invested.
This stuff might seem harmless on its surface, but this is the sort of thinking that puts women into a position where they start to want to control other women in order to reduce threats to themselves. And once you buy into the other women are the enemy mentality, you're primed to do things like think abortion should be banned and birth control regulated, so those scary other women that you think are on the prowl for your man get punished for their sexuality. Dr. Laura was also a major pusher of the narrative that retrograde gender roles are both what's good and natural, but also all women's fault anyway.
When the moms are working and the dads are at home, the moms, the women, the wives, tend to change their feelings somewhat about their husbands. They tend not to see them as the heroes, the warrior, the man, the caretaker, the provider, the protector. And those feelings are really very significant. And I have found over the years that there often is more marital strife when the roles are reversed. Whether you're a feminist or not, whether you like it or not, them's just the facts.
This is a constant drumbeat of Dr. Laura's, this notion that women don't really know what they want, that women say they want freedom and equality, but really they just want to be submissive to men. This is the same logic used to push anti-choice policies. Anti-feminists argue, over and over again, that the only reason women say they want things like access to reproductive health services or the right to sleep with who they want on their own terms is that those women are deluded. And then they need to be deprived of their choices because they don't know what they want. Here we have Dr. Laura singing the same song when it comes to women who work while their husbands stay at home. Amanda Hess also pointed to a video where Dr. Laura suggested that a woman who worked while her husband was unemployed should take the baby to work with her rather than allow a man do what she thinks is the degrading work of childcare. Dr. Laura was also in the habit of characterizing all disagreements between men and women as the result of women being childish and irrational.
A weak one is one you can make cower and do whatever you want at any time. A strong man is giving and loving but doesn't take any garbage from you. Come on, ladies, you know when he's a weak man. That's when his mother calls and he shakes. You give him an argument and he falls apart and can't function. And he's willing to do anything, even hurt himself, demean himself.
The notion that this is what women do as a matter of course, which is act irrational to test a man and pick fights just for the hell of it, is right in line with Dr. Laura's usual assumptions about women. This is what I mean by routine misogyny, and particularly in pushing the idea that women are too irrational to be allowed to make decisions. But even though Dr. Laura thinks women are too stupid to be trusted to make decisions, so she also holds them responsible for everything, including male behavior. She blamed women when their husbands cheat, for instance.
The cheating was his decision to repair what's damaged and to feed himself where he's starving. But yes, I hold women accountable for tossing out perfectly good men by not treating them with the love and kindness and respect and attention they need.
I could go on, mentioning the way Dr. Laura told women they owed their husbands sex on the man's terms no matter what, or the way she promoted the sexual double standard, or the various ways she abused her mostly female audience. But you get the picture. The point should be clear. Conservatives swear up and down their misogynist policy ideas have no relationship to actual misogynist beliefs. And yet, in right-wing land, Dr. Laura was a major self-help star because her shtick was often pure misogyny. You do the math. I'd like to welcome Daniel Reimold to the program. Dan is an impassioned college journalism scholar who has written and presented about the student press throughout the U.S. and in Southeast Asia. He's joined the faculty at the University of Tampa as an assistant professor of journalism. He's here today to talk about his new book, Sex and the University, Celebrity, Controversy, and a Student Journalism Revolution. Welcome to RealityCast, Dan.
Thank you for having me, Amanda. It's a pleasure.
So this book is about the surging trend of campus sex columns in campus sex magazines, a.k.a. college sexperts. What accounts for this sudden explosion in sex writing from students?
Yeah, it's been an incredibly interesting trend more than anything because it simply did not exist basically 12 to 15 years ago. And so there's been a host of factors, both pop cultural and within the media and with sort of larger shifting societal trend that has really led to the explosion of these sex columns and then also sex magazines and sex issues in the campus newspapers. Some point directly to a show like Sex and the City, which obviously, you know, has really been a direct influence on the type of writing that many of the columnists have been doing. Others point to larger factors, everything from the rise in co-ed dormitories to shows like Jerry Springer to the explosion of internet pornography and even just the sexuality of, you know, ever more mainstream media, some of the reality shows and, you know, more and more within the modern movies that younger people are seeing. Some even point to, you know, the continued rise of, you know, issues involving social networking, texting, and other avenues in which through new media, young people are able to, you know, learn a lot about sex at a much younger age.
What makes these kids who write these columns eligible for the lofty title of sexpert?
It's been one of the more interesting designations, I think, in modern pop culture and definitely in media circles. In many ways, the most fascinating thing about these students is that they do not aspire in any sense to be the so-called experts of sex. And if anything, they're selling themselves as the opposite. They're selling themselves as the everyday student. You know, they are on the peer level, you know, with their student readers, and they're presenting their own sort of highlights and lowlights of their love and lust and, you know, the dating and sex scene. And so really their expert status, if anything, comes from the fact that they are right there in the trenches, you know, and seeing and experiencing what other students are doing. And so it more than anything else, they're the ones showing up. They're putting their names out there, you know, they're writing about what all the other students are, you know, experiencing. And so it seems that this sexpert label, I think some tongue-in-cheek in certain cases, you know, due to the sort of the quality of the writing has just sort of come along with the positions themselves.
So what kind of picture of campus sex life are these sex columnists and sex magazine writers painting?
Yeah, this seems to be the thing that has gotten people most interested and even caused, in some cases, the most controversy. They're really painting a portrait, and certainly in general, or in certain cases symbolically, of a dating and sex scene that is really kind of exploding from a sexual level and kind of dying off on any sort of monogamy and hardcore relationship level. And I think the most interesting thing that I found just in reading through thousands of these things from student newspapers across the country and into Canada was a sense from the student columnists that dating is not so much dead, but it's jumping from one night stands, sex from the first meeting of a pair of students to really hardcore marriage-like commitment with basically no middle ground in between. And so the idea that the student columnists are putting forward is that dating, you know, in the traditional sort of dinner and a movie sense or sort of the courtship of times past is really dying off. There's a lot of sex going on, not a lot of protection being used. You know, there's a lot of sexual dangers out there and students are really, you know, kind of living their sexual lives out loud.
I've seen a lot of like national hysteria, I would say, over this so-called hookup culture is what it's getting called in the mainstream media. Did the students that you researched and interviewed feel that it was as bad a situation as it's being portrayed?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I think that kind of goes to the heart in a lot of cases of what the students are fighting against in the pieces that they've written and continue to write. The fascinating thing to me is that I've certainly read of these books. I think maybe the most prominent is Ben Shapiro's Porn Generation, you know, and a few others, even the one title Hooking Up, literally called. And the fascinating thing is that the columnists and some of these authors or researchers are saying the exact same things, and it's simply the perspectives that I've noticed are changed. A lot of the outsiders who are kind of feeding into this hysteria on the negatives of the trend really take a kind of parental, oh my God, sort of fear factor idea of what is happening to young people today. My goodness, this needs to be stopped. On the other side of things, the students, you know, either celebrating it or simply saying, back off, you know, everything is fine. This is not leading to some anarchic, you know, sort of social scene on campus. We're having a good time. We're getting to know each other and sort of the marriage and, you know, maybe the more traditional values and commitments, you know, come later in life. And so it's been fascinating that everyone's in agreement, but no one can really agree on what it all means. And the students are saying, we're fine with it and we're having a good time, and kind of back off, or you just don't get it.
One thing is interesting to me is that campuses tend to be tight-knit places. Now, I went to a small school, but this seems to be true even at big schools.
Yeah.
And so gushing this much about sex to people who know you and see you all the time has always seemed fraught to me. How do these sex columnists handle this?
It's incredible the amount of fame, and then I always say an infamy at the same time, that these columnists have accrued just for writing, you know, once a week in their student newspaper about sex and dating. It's absolutely true that, you know, even on the larger campuses, the student newspaper in many ways is the last truly hyper-local, you know, print media that exists. You know, even on the campuses with tens of thousands of students, it's still very much a kind of common together point, you know, in which, you know, the discussions that are raised in the newspaper can really be the starting points for discussions, you know, throughout campus. And so these students become stars. They're very well known. They're recognized from their headshots. They oftentimes pass people reading their columns. They get pointed at, stared at. Many of the columnists describe, sometimes creepily, being asked out on dates or more, you know, either in person or via Facebook friend requests. And, you know, they've had to also have some awkward conversations with employers, with, you know, admissions representatives for graduate schools. And even a few columnists told me, you know, their grandparents. You know, thanks to the power of Google, it's not something that you can really escape. And a few have, you know, been fine with that, and others have maybe wish they toned down a bit, or a rising trend I've seen is that more and more are writing with pen names of some sort to try and escape that, you know, the Google prints that will follow them once they graduate.
Barring the inevitable creepy dudes asking them out, and
girls as well. The male columnists apparently get a lot of attention. They're fewer and farther between in number. And so there seems to be a lot of interest from some of the female students on campus when the male students step up and write, for what it's worth.
So there are male students who do this, because it's always been my impression that this is incredibly female-dominated, almost exclusively female-dominated.
No, and you're absolutely right. I'd put it at maybe 80 to 85%, you know, female student-written. And also, it's generally the female students who are running these sex magazines and even writing the sex blogs that are now becoming popular among students. It's interesting that the male students that step up, and you know, this is a bit of a stereotype, but it also tends to be true, tend to be gay or tend to be incredibly self-effacing, sort of think the character of Chandler from Friends times 10. You know, and then, so they you seem to have to be a very certain type of male to step up and write this sort of column and reveal your identity publicly. It seems much more common for female students just across the spectrum, no matter what, to step forward and write this.
So this is something I think that carries on into sort of the adult post-college writing world, where you see a lot more female journalism attention paid towards sex, relationships, that sort of thing, and then second tier is gay men, and then like distant third, straight men. Did your research to point to any reason why that might be?
You know, I would say two things that immediately came to mind, and it was only the latter that worked its way into the book. The first is, more than anything, just on a base level or the most general level, there's a ton more female students in journalism programs currently nationwide. And it's getting to the point where, you know, more and more what I'm seeing in news reports that are cropping up, it's become, you know, literally almost entirely female classes. It's, you know, 60 to 70% of the entire newspaper staffs on the campus publications are, you know, female dominated. And so in many cases, in some ways, it's, you know, the female students are stepping up to write these things because they're stepping up to write more of almost everything. I think many of the female students were also influenced by Carrie Bradshaw, you know, and as silly, you know, or inconsequential as someone consider a show like that, you know, versus more serious or weighty fare, it definitely was a major influence, and it kind of now has hit a second wave, you know, in which the students who saw the students who were influenced by Carrie Bradshaw writing now want to be like those students. And so I think because it was a female trend from the start, it's now continued to be that way, especially with the text columns in particular. But otherwise, the one thing I found from talking with male columns is it seems like there is a sort of cultural norming in which the men really need to sort of break through the wall, you know, in order to feel comfortable writing about this. Apparently, they, you know, they get kind of razzed a lot more by their friends, especially the straight men. And there's kind of more of a cultural cliche that this is women's work, you know, or this is something that straight men need to sort of stay away from, you know, or you have a lot less room to sort of be funny or satirical without being attacked. And it's a shame because the male columnists that I've read, you know, tend to be quite funny, and it's almost refreshing in some ways to get their take on things.
Do you think that these college sex columnists have a positive impact on campus life? And if so, in what ways have they improved campus life?
Yeah. I'd say that the biggest positive is simply that they're talking about sex. They're talking about relationships. They're talking about the modern social scene. You know, they're showing first that it's okay to have these public discussions. They're showing these sorts of discussions can go beyond, you know, simply the cleavage shown in movies or sort of the shock rock Howard Stern type talk. You know, they're showing that sexual issues are on students' minds and it's something that needs to be addressed, you know, in more serious ways by the mainstream media. And they're kind of doing the professional press's job much better than they are. According to a Poynter study that was released a few years ago and a few other more minor studies that I've seen, the general sentiment toward professional journalism's coverage of sex and dating and related issues tend to be only featured on major diseases such as AIDS or HIV, or the sex lives of celebrities like Britney Spears or Mel Gibson. And so there's nothing of that sort of in between of sort of the everyday sex and dating stuff that obviously, you know, all of us are facing on some level, and especially students as they're kind of coming to grips with, you know, their own sexual and relationship identity. And so students are really leading the way in talking about this. And I really think it's helping, you know, the sexual and social culture. It's helping higher ed realize that they can deal with this as a serious issue. And I think it's really pushing journalism forward to realize that, you know, sex not only sells, but it can be a serious, you know, part of, you know, a random publication's editorial slate.
My guest today has been Daniel Reimold, and his book is called Sex and the University. It's Celebrity Controversy and a Student Journalism Revolution. You can buy it online or from local booksellers. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Dan.
Thank you very much for having me.
Another day, another story about anti-choicers doing everything they can to raise the abortion rate and the teenage childbirth rate. This time, it's in Colorado. A school clinic in Denver is starting to offer contraception services to kids grades 6 through 12 if their parents opt into the clinic services. This is the sort of thing that lowers the abortion rate, because if kids use condoms, they don't get pregnant, and if they don't get pregnant, they can't have abortions. So what do the anti-abortion fanatics have to say to this?
He believes this kind of offering will actually increase pregnancy rates.
The young girls are their own first line of defense.
So abstinence?
Yeah.
We're told over and over by anti-choicers that this isn't about hating on sex or women's rights, but that they just love fetuses. Of course, that doesn't do a thing to explain why they freak out reliably every time someone female may have sex without their explicit permission, even if there are no fetuses in danger, or even when the woman in question takes measures to keep herself from ever having an abortion. I'd say that perhaps they're just full of it, and that their willingness to let girls get pregnant as punishment for sex tells us the whole story. The local CBS affiliate did a story where they interviewed angry parents, and all of them had rather incoherent, illogical reactions.
I think it's ridiculous it's even talked about, yes. Yeah, that's crazy.
In other words, I don't have an argument, just a gut reaction. I don't think there should be discussion about it because I don't have any coherent reasons for my point of view. I call this the strict reactionary defense.
Right now, I'm not ready to go through that explanation with my daughter. I do feel it's a time and a place for it. With the, like I said again, with the way society is running, with the open dialogue, you have to engage when the appropriate time. As far as the school, especially this young age when they're very impressionable, I don't think that's a very good idea.
Translation: my child's sexuality makes me uncomfortable, and I'm hoping if I ignore it, it will go away. You would think that for parents who are made so uncomfortable by the topic, it would be a relief to have the school take that on for them. As for the whole notion that later is always a good time for this talk, the student body at this school is post-pubescent. Many of them are having sex, and almost all of them are thinking about it a lot. When is a good time to talk to kids? After they turn up pregnant or with STDs?
Them are not even in their period. Most of the kids enter 11 years in here, so 10 years. I don't know, it's too early.
If they're too young to want to be having sex, the mere fact that contraception is available isn't going to make them change their minds. The news reporters seem interested in making the parents focus on the fact that 6th graders go to this school, as if this suddenly means that the 12th graders and their needs don't count. 6th graders aren't, generally speaking, reading on a 12th grade level. Does that mean that the library shouldn't carry books for the seniors? Part of the problem here is the usual political problem where you get less credit for preventing a problem than fixing one. You're unlikely to think the school if your daughter comes home not pregnant, because that's just the status quo. But in many cases, you should thank the school if that's the outcome, especially if you're like these parents and unlikely to be providing that help yourself. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Projection Edition. Glenn Beck wants to force women to carry babies to term against their will. But he thinks of himself as a hero and a victim, so he has to make stuff up to confuse the reality of who's the one demanding oppression.
Why did the Obama administration, a mere 5 weeks into his presidency, officially state their intention to rescind a Bush-era regulation called the Freedom of Conscience Act? That.
Well, what does that mean?
It means if something bothers you, you better do it. Unless this was in. See, the act cut off all federal funds to hospitals or clinics or health care plans that didn't accommodate doctors and other health care providers who refused to participate in care that they felt violated their personal, moral, or religious beliefs. Here's what our administration said. Well, we've been concerned that the way the Bush rule was written, it could make it harder for women to get the care that they need. May I? Because I'm an alcoholic. I'm a recovering alcoholic. So I speak fluent bullcrap. I can translate bullcrap to English. It's not that hard. Once you've really done a lot of alcohol in your life, man, that bull crap runs right out of your mouth. So here it is, BS to English. The care that they need equals abortions.
In his long, roundabout way, Beck is claiming the Obama administration is forcing doctors to do abortions. This isn't true. A separate law than the one he's talking about protects a doctor's right to refuse abortions. The Bush-era law was much broader, protecting all healthcare workers who blocked access to contraception, vaccines, blood transfusions, you name it. So Beck is lying about everything, except the fact that he speaks fluent bullcrap.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.